This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Ruth Reichel, the restaurant critic of the New York Times, is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Ruth Reichel has been the restaurant critic at the New York Times since 1993. She's also been restaurant critic and food editor at the Los Angeles Times, that prior to her coming to the New York Times. In the mid-1970s, she was chef and co-owner of the Swallow Restaurant in Berkeley. In her memoir, Tender at the Bone, Ruth Reichel writes about growing up and the wonderful characters who peopled her life and helped shape her life. In Tender at the Bone, Reichel says she discovered as a girl, quoting here, food could be a way of making sense of the world. If you watched people as they ate, you could find out who they were. She also discovered at a tender age that just as food sustains and comforts, it can kill you if you're not careful. More on that in a moment. As we talk, I hope you'll join the conversation. Your phone calls for Ruth Reichel are encouraged. Here are the phone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else you happen to be listening in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Ruth Reichel's memoir, Tender at the Bone, Growing Up at the Table, is published by Random House. Ruth Reichel, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Do you remember a moment when you realized, the moment when you realized food could be a way of making sense of the world?
Well, there was a moment when I was about, I was really young, when my mother put some butter on the table and buttered my bread, and I tasted it and said, I can't eat this. And she tasted it and said, it tastes fine to me. And I tasted it again, and it was butter that she had left uncovered in the refrigerator for a long time, so it had that really rank taste that things that have been uncovered in the refrigerator get. And I realized, I mean, I was maybe three, and I realized that she and I were not tasting the same thing, that there was this profound difference. And you know, it's one of those epiphanies that you usually have later in your life when you realize that you're different than your parents, that you're very separate.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this moment so clearly that right then I became curious about, you know, what were these differences between all of us? And I started really paying attention to what people ate.
Do you ever think to yourself, what is it about me that makes me so different from my parents in the area of food and taste?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's one of these things that all of us at some point in our lives say, you know, what makes me so different than, you know, my parents? I mean, hopefully that happens to you at some point. But certainly, for me, I mean, I grew up in a household that had, I mean, basic disdain for the idea of food. I mean, my parents were intellectuals, and they did not think that food, I mean, they you know, liked the idea of eating well, but they certainly didn't think it was a fit topic for mm-hmm. discussion or thought. And the whole time that I was growing up, and as I got older, and as I actually started writing about food, my parents both, especially my mother, kept saying, you know, aren't you ever going to do something reasonable with your life? Why are you, you know, all you ever think about is food. You know, come on, grow up, be a serious person. And I'm sure if she were alive today, she would still be saying that.
Well, you were quite young as well when you realized that your mother was really a menace in the kitchen. She could be dangerous.
Yeah, she was dangerous.
And, you know, in an early scene in Tender at the Bone, you would describe the breakfast table, and it sounds very nice. And then you open the door wide. You want to tell us that anecdote that you tell and your father would tell about?
Yes. I for the longest time, I had a very hard time believing that this was true, but it was told in my family, in my mother's presence. My mother woke my father up one morning, and you have to really picture my father as this very courtly, he was a gentleman, and he woke up slowly, and my mother was up very, very early, and she was desperate for him to get out of bed, and finally she couldn't wait any longer, and she went and shook him awake and said, "You come into the kitchen, I need you." And he groped his way very sleepily down the hall and into the kitchen, and she stuck something in his mouth and said, "Taste this." And my father said that it was the worst thing he had ever experienced. It was just, everything in him tried to swallow it because it was the polite thing to do, but he couldn't, and he leaned over and spit it out into the sink. At which point my mother said, "Just as I thought, spoiled."
"Taste this, see if it's bad."
And I mean, the truth is that, I mean, I used this story because I thought it told in one very small story volumes about both of my parents. And in my mother's case, you know, one, she really couldn't tell if it was spoiled. So it wasn't just that she, you know, she was doing something awful to him. She really needed to know. I mean, she was taste blind. But the other thing is that she wasn't ashamed of having done this. This story was told in her presence, and she thought it was a perfectly reasonable thing to do to someone, wake them up in the morning and give them something rotten.
Away from the kitchen, what was your mom like?
Well, we discovered when I was older, I was almost a teenager before we really, you know, discovered that there was a name for what my mother's problem was. My mother was a manic depressive. She was a classic manic depressive, which meant that she went through times of, you know, real eccentric, erratic behavior. When she would, you know, not sleep for days on end. And she was great fun when she was like that for everyone, probably, but me. You know, she was very curious about the world. She was very bright. She was full of projects, and especially when she was high. I mean, the other side of it was when she was depressed. I mean, there were months when she didn't get out of bed. And I mean, one of the things that happened to me when I got older is, I mean, I think I was very fortunate in that I was not a child who was ever told this is normal behavior. I mean, it was always sort of acknowledged that there was something not quite right about my mother. And so instead of anger at it, although, I mean, it's hard not to get angry when it's really imposed on you, but I think I woke up most days very grateful that I wasn't my mother. Grateful that I, you know, was sort of a normal person and woke up every morning knowing who I was. I mean, my mother was a person who went to bed every night with very little idea of who she would be when she woke up in the morning. You know, she might be someone, you know, with enormous energy who was running around having parties. Mm-hmm. And her parties were unbearable. It just completely out of control. I mean, one of the stories in the book is about one of these really insane parties where she ended up inviting a couple hundred people and calling the press, and it got more and more grandiose, her projects, and she ended up poisoning people.
Yeah, and it was in the 1960s, and party favors were anti-nuclear.
Yeah, well, my mother actually was a friend of Bertrand Russell's, and it took me to meet him. And at one of their occasions, he had given her a series of little booklets that were this very amusing anti-nuclear tract that he had written with cartoon drawings, and they were all signed, and she had, I don't know, a few hundred of these. And she decided that for my brother's engagement party, she would make it a fundraiser for UNICEF and have these as favors. And, oh my poor brother was horrified. I mean, one, she was
Having this party to introduce the two families, and suddenly his future in-laws were expected to pay to come to this party. And next, these very conservative businessmen were being treated to this. These are the days when Russell was going around saying, you know, better red than dead, and he was a very controversial figure. My mother was very proudly handing out these favors, which, I wish I had them today. But, they were wonderful things for certain people and not so wonderful to other people.
Yeah.
And then, of course, she ended up literally putting, 26 of my brother's future in-laws in the hospital with stomach with food poisoning at this same party.
Oh, your poor brother.
She was a character.
Yeah.
My brother has never forgiven her for that one. Never.
I can't blame him. That's a tough one. Eventually, she was diagnosed, and she took lithium. So were her later years less tortured for her?
Somewhat. In the early days of lithium, it was very touch and go. I mean, they really didn't know how to use it very well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is in the early 60s she started taking it. I think she was one of the first people. And getting the balance, it took years till they really could figure out what combination of drugs worked for her. And they never, what they were able to do was control the terrible highs. I mean, she never had really, really insane episodes again after she started taking lithium. But they could never, ever, to the end of her life, control the depressions. So she still had crippling depression. And in fact, I think died of depression. I mean, in her 80s, went into a depression that she never came out of.
And your father, he loved her very much. I get the sense of your father as a gentle, loving man, also very intelligent. But he was, I sense very hurt by her illness, as you were.
Yeah, no, he really did love her. I mean, I think they had, through all of this, a wonderful relationship, a very loving relationship. They loved each other very much, and he was as supportive as he knew how to be. But it's very difficult dealing with this kind of, you don't even know who you're dealing with half the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was very hurt by her illness. But on the other hand, he was right there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He never shied away from it.
Mm-hmm. And because of your mother's illness, you didn't, for a long time, know who your father was in a real sense.
Well, I'm not even sure it was because of my father's illness. I mean, of my mother's illness. I mean, I think my father was also very much, he was a very European man. And he didn't talk about himself easily. I have a chapter called Love Story, and it's really about the love between my father and my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really through Doug that I got to know my father. I mean, my father met this young man who he really admired and really loved and sort of opened up in a way that he never had to me. And through their relationship, I met my father.
Hmm.
It's really a privilege to be able to have that happen. And I was very fortunate in that, I always felt very loved. And one of the things that happens when you have this kind of a parent who's mentally ill this way, if your parents handle it well, what I felt was very competent as a child, and as, in fact, as an adult, And so, I felt, you know, when I took over the family cooking, which I did, and sort of the food, all the food became mine at some point. And I got a great sense of, you know, my own worth in the world through doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when I did really meet my father as a real person and find out who he was, I was ready for him.
Hmm. Three cheers for Doug coming along.
Yeah, I was very lucky.
Yeah, for everybody. You, your husband, your son, do the three of you spend time together in the kitchen?
Well, you know, I'm a restaurant critic now, so I don't cook very much anymore.
Uh-huh.
I go out for, you know, something 10 or 12 meals a week. So we don't spend a lot of time in the kitchen.
Hmm. Do you regret that?
Very much. You know, I regret family meals. I mean, I regret it for not just for myself. I regret it for all of America. I mean, I think that we as a nation have lost something very valuable in losing, you know, that tradition of family meals, which we had for, you know, much of our history, and which we seem to be losing very quickly. I mean, food today increasingly is becoming, you know, meals are something that we all do alone, even in families. You know, the kids have football practice, and you know, mom's working late, and dad's, you know, out of town, and somehow everybody's picking up food as they can. So, I mean, I don't think it's just in my family that we're not having family meals, but I think we are really missing something very valuable in this.
Isn't it interesting, though, that we see a great interest in food, in outfitting kitchens, in cooking vacations? Why do you suppose that's so? What's going on?
Well, I think we know that food is important and that cooking is important, and I think we really know that we're missing something and we're trying to make up for it. You know, suddenly cooking has become a recreation now, instead of, you know, something that's done every day as a matter of course. And I think, you know, we're trying to, I mean, it's much in the way that we used to exercise naturally. I mean, people didn't used to have to go to gyms because they were, you know, working hard every day. And suddenly, you know, because that's not what we do anymore, we have to find another way to do it because we understand that exercise is really important. Cooking is—it's important. It's an important function, and we're trying to figure out how we can make it part of our lives. I think we're in a transitional stage. I mean, I really do think that we're going to come back to, you know, real daily cooking. I just don't know how we're going to do it.
Yeah. Now, as a restaurant critic, can one take one's family to the restaurant?
It's not the same. I mean, you don't. I mean, a restaurant meal. I mean, first of all, I'm working, so it's not
right.
Like I'm there and totally available. I mean, I'm there with all my, you know, antenna out, trying to pay attention to what's going on at other tables, and you know, I'm not sitting there having a good discussion about what went on at school today. And I also think that there's a real profound difference in how you eat in a restaurant and how you eat at home. It, you know, restaurants are and should be special occasion places. They're, you don't really want that to be your everyday life as a family, I don't think. You know, you want the kind of stretching out you do at a table and the kind of you can linger, you can get up, you can walk around, you can decide let's have dessert later and we'll take a walk now. I mean, all of those things are an important part, you know, setting the table and, you know, all of those are an important part of the family meal. And it's not what happens in a restaurant.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, any time that you sit down at a table together is better than any time that you don't. I mean, I do think that, you know, one of the great functions of eating together is the communication that takes place between people. And if the only place you can do that is a restaurant, it's far better to do that than not to do it at all.
Mm-hmm. Is your son a child who likes to eat?
I think all children like to eat if you figure out, you know, if you don't make a nightmare out of it. He is a child who is gradually expanding his food horizons. He's nine now. As a younger child, he ate very little. I mean, he really had, you know, one of those, I only eat white food, I eat, you know, milk, bread, eggs. It was very limited. And my most heartfelt belief is you let it alone, that you let people come to this in their own time. And with him, it's certainly, you know, it's amazing. Just in the last year, suddenly, he's open to everything. But I think that if you make eating a nightmare, you know, you will eat that. You'll sit here until it's mm-hmm. gone. You make the table a battlefield. And you create people who never like to eat. You know, he's always gotten great pleasure out of eating a few things, and those few things are becoming more and more and more. It makes me so happy.
I'm married to someone who was like that until he was well into his adult years. So it's great fun to watch.
But, I mean, people do change. I mean, mm-hmm. given the opportunity, I think, you know, it's natural to like to eat. And, you know, people say, oh, children don't like to eat. I mean, that's nonsense. All children like to eat something.
Yes. And tell us about your experiences as the guest of Monsieur Ducroix. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Ducroix.
His wife and their daughter, your boarding school friend, Beatrice. Well, how old were you? And share with us some of the meals that you shared as a child there.
Well, this boarding school experience was so extraordinary in every way. I mean, it begins with my mother in one of her truly manic episodes deciding to ship me off to a French-speaking boarding school in the middle of the school year. I mean, she picked me up outside of school and said, we're going to Canada for the weekend, and I never came home. And there I called this chapter Mars. Because, I mean, there I was in a French school. It was a school run by the French government for the children of their diplomatic corps, mostly, and actually many, as there are American schools all over the world, there are French schools all over the world. And I didn't speak a word of French. I had no friends. It was initially the most miserable I have ever been in my life. I did nothing but cry for days, weeks, months, and call my parents every night and beg them to let me come home, which they didn't. And my salvation in this, it was another moment when food saved my life. I mean, food has been saving my life all of my life. But on this occasion, I had an enemy who was the richest girl in school, Beatrice, and I stayed in the school on weekends. It was most of the kids went home to their families on the weekends, but I was there mostly alone. And one weekend she was made to stay as a punishment, and we grudgingly became friends, and she asked me home with her on the next weekend. And she had, I doubt that even in France there are relationships like this anymore, but she had a very formal relationship with her parents. She used the formal form of address with them. She called them vous, which shocked me. And she sort of lived on a separate floor in the house and had very little contact with them. But because she had brought a guest home, her parents had lunch with us the first day I was there. And her father was a great gourmet. And this meal was a revelation to me. I mean, here I had the first souffle I had ever pasted, and fabulous French cheese, and great olive oil, and one dish, I mean, a soup that was unlike anything I had ever experienced before. And it was like I had been asleep and woken up to the possibility of eating this kind of food. And Monsieur Ducroix, seeing that I was so taken with this, appeared at dinner. And Béatrice was shocked because her parents never had dinner with her. And suddenly, he was showing up at meals. I was being invited home on weekends. And Béatrice discovered that she could learn to know her father through food.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to see the two of them become close, because it had never occurred to her before that her father was really that interested. But looking at me and his sudden interest, and suddenly he was there at all our meals, I learned about food. I also suddenly became happy. I mean, I had a friend. I had a place to go on the weekends. School suddenly worked for me. I was suddenly speaking French. And for me, it was this amazing awakening. And I got to see my friend really sort of seduce her father.
Hmm. She awakened, too.
Yes, absolutely.
And you introduced her to pastrami on rye.
Oh, yes, and to Chinese food. But smoked meat is the great Montreal food, and she had never had it before, and she loved it. And she was also, as am I, a prodigious eater, so we had a wonderful time together.
Yeah. What is chartreuse of partridge?
Oh, it's one of those unbelievably complicated French dishes, which are hardly, you know, there was a time when French food was about total transformation. The whole tradition of haute cuisine was to take ingredients and transform them into something utterly new. And it's a partridge and vegetable dish in aspic that, when turned out, looks exactly like a Venetian paperweight. It's the most spectacular-looking thing you've ever seen. It's, you know, one of those moments of food magic the first time you see it.
In a recent piece in the New York Times, you say of great haute cuisine that it provides a meal of the imagination, and that chartreuse of partridge certainly is a flight of imagination, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, there are people who think of food as art and, you know, really do something alchemical in it, with, you know, transforming these dishes, and they have to be able to imagine it first. I mean, they have to be able to, you know, look at a bird and think, oh, that could be a paperweight.
Ruth Reichel is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with her about her memoir, Tender at the Bone, Growing Up at the Table. She is the restaurant critic for the New York Times. As we talk, you're welcome to join us in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number 333-9455. Outside Champaign-Urbana, anywhere you're listening, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Well, thinking of Béatrice and smoked meat on rye with mustard makes me think of your Aunt Bertie's potato salad.
Oh, it is the greatest potato salad.
Wouldn't those two things go well together?
They would. They would. Well, but I think Aunt Bertie's potato salad would go with anything.
Was that one of the first things that you learned to cook?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Aunt Bertie was, I mean, when I first started thinking about writing this book, I mean, there are a few people who just instantly demanded to be talked about, and one was Mrs. Peavy, and one was certainly Aunt Bertie. And what I really wanted to talk about with Aunt Bertie was my Aunt Bertie, who lived to be 102 and was not really my aunt. She was my father's first wife's mother. And my father and his first wife had had no children. So when I was born, Aunt Bertie went to the hospital, introduced herself to my mother, and said, you know, I would really like to be a grandmother to this girl. And one of my mother's great qualities is that she was a generous person. And she took care of Aunt Bertie. You know, in later years, Aunt Bertie actually introduced her as my daughter-in-law. Mm-hmm. But Aunt Bertie came into my life, and I spent many weekends with her. And she had a maid named Alice, who I realized that these two women were friends, although they didn't think of themselves that way. They had been together for most of their lives. I mean, when I met them, they'd known each other for 60-some years and had spent virtually every day of those 60-some years together without ever sort of thinking of what they had as a relationship. And as a little girl, I came in and, you know, would spend weekends with them. And, you know, one day I looked at Alice and said, do you like Aunt Bertie? And she looked at me as if, you know, it was one of those questions you didn't ask. I mean, it was something she'd never thought about. And then she sort of nodded and said, yes, I do. And she seemed surprised by her own answer. But Alice was an extraordinary cook. I mean, one of those real natural cooks. And another person, as I turned out to be, for whom, you know, food was a real life changer. I mean, she became a queen through her cooking. And she got enormous respect from everyone, be it the grocers. And this was not easy because Aunt Bertie had and Uncle Perry had been very wealthy, and they had lost all of their money in the stock market crash. And my Uncle Perry, who had retired at the age of 40, suddenly had to go to work and worked for the rest of his life, even as a very old man, and they had nothing. And at that time, in 1929, Aunt Bertie had gone to Alice and said, you know, I'm sorry, but we can't afford you anymore. And Alice had said, I'm staying. I know you'll be fair. Pay me what you can, and had stayed forever. But they lived in what was essentially a slum. So for her to, you know, get respect in this community from these grocers who half the time they, you know, were behind in the bills was a real feat. But when I went with her to the store, I saw that, you know, they thought that she was something. She was something. And she could cook anything. And how she would entertain me on weekends was cooking. And so, you know, Aunt Bertie taught me to make her potato salad, which was the only dish she knew how to cook. It was literally the only thing she'd ever cooked in her whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And then Alice taught me to make fried oysters and apple dumplings and hard sauce and chicken croquettes and, you know, anything that sort of, that I could think of, she could make.
Mm-hmm. And Aunt Bertie's potato salad is so marvelously simple. It's small potatoes, salt and pepper, sugar, onions, vegetable oil, white vinegar, and a little sugar.
But as Aunt Bertie said, the secret is in boiling that vinegar. you get the vinegar, you make the vinegar boil, and then you pour it over the still warm sliced potatoes. And there's something about the way it gets absorbed that it's very elemental.
Mm-hmm.
And Aunt Bertie never showed up at our house without a jar of potato salad.
Mm. One of your father's favorites.
It was. It absolutely was. And one of mine.
Mm. And now please tell us about Mrs. Peavy.
Oh, Mrs. Peavy was... one of the things that distressed me about the book is that because we had a maid everybody assumed that we were wealthy. We were not wealthy. I mean, money was a real problem in our household. But my mother worked with my father, and we almost always had a maid. And one of them was Mrs. Peavy, who was this very patrician woman in her 60s, quite stout, who she lived with us and had a silver goblet with her initials on it that she took into her bedroom every night. And she would drop these little tidbits, like when we had tea at the Rockefellers, things like that. She would talk about being in Europe, being on these cruise ships. She spoke many languages very fluently. And she was a total mystery. I would hear my mother and her friends talking about what her story must be. I mean, why she was working for us. I mean, who this patrician woman with the silvery hair who was ironing our sheets, what she was doing in our household. And she never told my mother, never told actually any of us, but she did give me little hints. So this chapter is really about the mystery of Mrs. Peavy and who she is and why she's working for us and why she, too, is this extraordinary cook.
Mm-hmm.
And she was really, I mean, one of the people who was really important in my life.
Mm-hmm.
She was a real point of stability.
She was one of your greatest teachers.
She was, absolutely. I would stand with her in the kitchen as she cooked and talked and told me stories about her life and, made magic in the kitchen.
Don't forget the extra pastry.
Well, that was, she was also one of these people who was very foresighted, and the time that she dropped the beef Wellington, she said, "Don't worry, Mrs. Reichel, I'll just get the other one." Went back into the kitchen, patched it up with the extra pastry, and sailed back out into the dining room as if the second one had just emerged from the oven.
Yeah. And her, when she left you and your family, it was a moment of great opportunity for her. And another point in the book where readers will, I think, find themselves cheering. Even though you say she was, had a great deal of foresight, she also...
She had clearly many problems.
Right. But yet she wouldn't give up. She was going to go on.
And she had... an epiphany. I mean, she had a moment when she realized that this really wasn't what she should be doing and that she really had to follow her talent. I mean, she was an extraordinary cook and it's what she'd always wanted to do, and that it was really time for her to take hold and, make her own destiny. That she had had a piece of bad luck and that she couldn't give in to that. And so she sort of squared her shoulders and moved on. I mean, the sad thing about much of this, I have no idea. After she left us, I have no idea what happened to her. And I have tried. I mean, I have this scene in the book where her three sons come to visit her in a chauffeur-driven limousine, which was one of these, jaw-dropping moments. And I have had, I have tried to find her descendants, but I have had no luck with that.
Hmm. As an adult, who have been your teachers?
Oh, I have had so many. I mean, I had great good luck in, when I was in college, I worked in restaurants. And the first restaurant I worked in was one of those dream restaurants. I mean, I always think of very good restaurants as being like movie sets in that everybody pulls together and you become a family. And my great good fortune was in the first restaurant that I worked in, having some of the best restaurant people I've ever encountered since as mentors. I mean, people. There was a wonderful waitress and the world's best waiter, and they were very important to me and taught me an enormous lot. I had the great good fortune much, much later of learning about wine from Kermit Lynch, and, who is a wonderful wine importer, and, you know, tagging around, you know, following in his footsteps as he went on these buying forays in Europe. And then the person who I sort of adopted as a mother later in my life was Marion Cunningham, mm-hmm. who has been just enormously generous with me and continues to be. And, I mean, if you're going to find a person in the food world to sort of shepherd you through, you couldn't do better than Marion.
She's a little Mrs. Peavy-like, too, I think.
I hadn't thought of that, actually. But, of course, you're absolutely right. Very Mrs. Peavy-like, actually. You know, a woman who overcame enormous personal problems. I mean, she is a woman who was so phobic that at the age of 45, she had never left the state of California, never been on an airplane. She was afraid of leaving her own house. And, you know, overcame all that and remade herself totally in middle age and is, I think, a great inspiration to many people. I mean, the idea that you can do that, that you can be a grown person, you know, with a long marriage and, you know, grown children and, you know, say, I can change. I can be someone else and really become the person you were meant to be. Hmm.
I think this would be a kind of a bittersweet moment here, I'm afraid, because it's time to wrap up, but what a wonderful point to wrap up. I want to thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon, and a toast to all the characters that have been a part of your life. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much.
And Ruth Reichel has been our guest, and I want to thank her once again. Look for her book, Tender at the Bone, Growing Up at the Table. The book is published by Random House. Ruth Reichel is restaurant critic of the New York Times.